It's Wednesday, May 3rd, and I feel like I've read this script before. We start here.
Whose stories?
Our stories!
15 years after shutting down Hollywood, writers once again go on strike.
The middle class of writing is dying, and that's what I feel like we're most advocating for.
But the modern plotline has these union members feeling more like gig workers. President Biden dispatches troops to the southern border.
If you have migrants surging over, thousands of them at one time, where are they going to go?
Is this policy just Trump 2.0? And the Supreme Court is used to having the final say.
The highest court in the land should not have the lowest ethical standards.
Now Congress weighs whether it could or even should rein in the justices. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. People always describe film as a director's medium, like it's a team effort, but the whole project takes its cue from a director. TV, though, is a writer's medium. Every scripted show you watch has a showrunner and a team of writers constantly scripting out the next beats. Directors almost become interchangeable. Actors can be killed off mid-season. So yesterday, when the Writers Guild of America decided to go on strike, the entire landscape of entertainment was thrown into disarray. What does this mean for workers? And crucially, what does this mean for your binging habits? Let's go straight to ABC's entertainment correspondent, Jason Nathanson, who is based in Hollywood, was actually walking the picket lines yesterday. Jason, can you just give me a sense of how big these strikes are?
This is big. This affects a lot of places. The studios all around town, from Warner Brothers in Burbank to Disney to Sony to Paramount, Netflix.
Let's get in line and start marching.
All these different lots that are in Los Angeles are all being picketed.
We do not tolerate scabs in the city of Burbank.
There are places in New York, Atlanta.
New York is a union town.
There are pickets, from what I understand, in London.
Oh, wow.
This is a worldwide thing because there is production going on worldwide. And the Writers Guild has a lot of people, you know, 9,000 or so people who are very upset about what's going on.
Yeah, and you mentioned Disney. That's our parent company. It just speaks to how so many things you see have union writers attached to them. What are they asking for?
This is all about streaming services, right? Mm. Which didn't exist in 2007. Netflix existed, but it was renting out DVDs in a red envelope. Its business model completely changed. The business itself completely changed.
Whose stories?
Our stories!
A lot of the writers have said, as that business has changed and as these big studios have made a lot of money, the writers haven't kept up with those changes and those profits as well.
The middle class of writing is dying, and that's what I feel like we're most advocating for. So writers, lower-level writers, mid-level writers, who are talented and deserve, when they get a job, to be able to make enough money to live on it.
So they want things like better pay. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, the basis of most strikes is just a hike in wages.
But we are taxed at a higher rate. We are forced to live in more expensive cities. 25% of it goes out the door immediately to our managers, our agents, our accountants, our all these things that are mandatory for us to exist in this space.
But also, the business model has changed. So you used to, as a writer, get this secondary source of income in residuals, which writers still do off broadcast shows and cable shows.
Oh, like this is where you get like the check in the mail for your old Law and Order episode or something.
Exactly. And you're getting that based on the show being sold over and over again, whether it's to a new cable streaming service or, in reruns and syndication or whatever. But on streaming services, that's not happening. If a show's on Netflix, it's on Netflix. They're not going anywhere else. So you are losing that secondary source of income if you are a writer. You're not getting those checks in the mail over and over and over again. So they want to change the structure on residuals as well. Then there are other things.
Well, in the last writer's strike, a lot of the questions were just kind of like, is streaming really going to be that big of a deal? Is this something to be concerned about? And we were right to be concerned about it because look at what streaming is now.
In 2007, they didn't know about streaming services, right? Now, they want to make sure that AI is not going to be writing shows 15 years from now.
Come on, Terminator, right there, Skynet, written by a writer, by the way. So we come up with the idea, and then they go and create it and turn it against us, the writers, and we can't make a living? That.
The Writers Guild wants the studios to agree no AI writing of shows. Apparently, from what the Writers Guild has said, the studios came back and said, we'll have meetings about that every year as things go on, but we won't say absolutely no AI.
So what is the stance of the studios right now? Like, how does this get resolved? Is there any sign of that happening?
The studios, which is collectively the AMPTP, the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, they have said that they want to keep talking. That's what they said in their statement. They said that they were willing to come up on compensation, that they were willing to come up on residuals as well. A couple of things that they weren't willing to really, the sticking points they said were mandatory staffing, which is this thing about how many writers have to be on a show, that there are mandatory minimums for the number of writers per show, which is something the Writers Guild wanted, and the duration of time.
There's less episodes. You know, they used to be paid episodically, and there used to be 22 episodes. Now the average order is 6, 8, 10, but they're still taking the same amount of time as 22 episodes to make.
The amount that you're paid per episode is actually a lot less than it once was. So they want mandatory length of time to be staffed on a show. The studios are saying that's not really something that they want.
And not to make it all about, like, me and our listeners here, but, like, how does this affect stuff we watch, Jason? Like, what actually happens starting now because of this strike?
Sure. So the immediate effect that you have already seen is that the late night shows, those are gone, right? They've gone into reruns. They need writers to power those shows, although they can do it without the writers. But some of them, like Jimmy Fallon, I know, is a Writers Guild member and, you know, the host of a show.
Yeah, I need my writers. I need them real bad.
So he is going on strike as well to support his staff and his union.
We have a lot of staff and crew that will be affected by this, you know, but, you know, they got to get a fair deal.
Saturday Night Live, which has 3 episodes left in this season, that's going to go away, depending on how long the strike lasts, of course. As far as the other effects on your scripted shows, it's interesting. This strike comes at a very interesting time, especially for broadcast. Broadcast, you could see an effect there. Except most of the shows are ending, right? The seasons are almost over. We're in May. The May sweeps. Most of those shows, the broadcast shows, they're about to be done. They're about to be at the end of their seasons. So you won't see an effect on that. It depends on how long the strike goes, though. If it goes the 100 days, which the one in 2007 went, that will certainly affect the upcoming broadcast season in September.
Is this actually hurting you financially or making it tough for you to live?
Well, if it hurt, you know, it's hurting everyone. So it's hurting actors. It's hurting technical people. It's hurting, you know, even the executives who are, you know, committed to us and help us get our shows on the air.
A lot of these shows either can't keep going forward or they can't do new ones, right? And if you're not making a new show, well, then you're not building sets for a new show. You're not catering a new show.
Right.
You're not costuming a new show. It affects the economies of Los Angeles and New York and Atlanta and all these hubs very significantly. The last estimate of the 2007 strike, which was shut things down for 100 days, the estimate on that was $2.1 to $3 billion. It's not just that's what the studios lost in revenue. That was the economic impact to Los Angeles.
Really interesting moment here. All right, we'll see what happens. Jason Nathanson, thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
Next up on Start Here, how's this for a sequel? New president, same troop deployment to the border. We're back in a bit.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
I want you to circle a day on your mental calendar. Think about next Thursday. For anyone who follows immigration, May 11th is about to be a huge moment, because that's the day Title 42 expires, the pandemic-era rule that allows the U.S. government to boot foreigners, including migrants who come here to claim asylum, without even offering them a hearing. When that rule goes away on May 11th, the thinking goes, walking across that border will get a whole lot more enticing. With that in mind, yesterday, the Biden administration dusted off a page from President Trump's playbook, the same page that infuriated Democrats not too long ago and decided to send U.S. troops to the border. ABC's Maria Villarreal is based in Texas. Maria, what is the plan here?
First of all, I have to say, Brad, the fact that you even asked people to make a mental note of an immigration date, it actually warms my heart, because this is such an important part of what is happening, not just on the southern border, but really in our government. So when it comes to the 1,500 troops that are going to go down to the border, they will not have the ability to perform any sort of law enforcement duties. So you won't see these guys patrolling the border. This is very reminiscent of what we saw a few years ago during the Trump administration. He sent down troops to the border as well. A lot of it is for show. It is to give support in some way, shape, or form that looks really good. But the reality is we've spoken directly with Chief Raul Ortiz. You know, he recently told us on an embed that he needs people to help him process.
Certainly need more Border Patrol agents out here on the front lines. I need to be able to build an enterprise behind them to process the migrants that we encounter each and every day.
He needs people to help them watch the cameras that they have set up. He needs people to help with transportation. All of these things may or may not be able to be done with the 1,500 troops that are coming in, but there is a possibility.
And I'm sorry, Maria, like, didn't the Trump administration do a similar thing? And didn't Democrats, including, I think, the current vice president, call this move, like, morally abhorrent, sending active duty military to the border? But, like, what do those Democrats say now that it's President Biden doing it?
You know, I think for the most part, we have seen Democrats be very quiet about the more recent steps that we've seen taken by the Biden administration. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that a lot of what is coming out of the Biden administration is very new, honestly. So there can't be a whole lot of reaction to it. A lot of this is recycled. It is throwing spaghetti against the wall for this administration and hoping that something will stick.
DOD personnel have been supporting CBP at the border for almost two decades now. So this is a common practice.
During a White House briefing, you know, it was talked about what is the president's future goal. And it was very clear that these next few weeks are a stepping stone for this administration.
The president understands that we need a system, an immigration system that needs to meet the moment, that's modernized.
Unfortunately, I'm not sure they know exactly what works. And so a lot of what we are seeing is a trial and error situation.
Yeah, and that's my last question for you is, I mean, what does happen next? You're going to have these troops at the border. Like you said, they're not going to have law enforcement capabilities exactly. So, I mean, what could this end up looking like even with those military members there?
So I think the biggest concern right now that Border Patrol agents are telling us, the chief of Border Patrol is telling us, is he is concerned about the potential for a bottleneck effect. I mean, what Title 42 did was allow agents to quickly expel migrants from the United States. So they may cross over into the United States illegally across the river, let's just say. Agents would pick them up, and then within really 24 hours, maybe even less, they would be going back across the border into Mexico. So that tool is going away. We do have other tools in place for agents to use. The biggest one you'll see talked a lot about in the next week or so is going to be Title 8. And that is basically an immigration law that is in place and has been in place before. This does allow migrants to come in and to request asylum. While they are doing that and they're going through the process, they are being held to some extent by Border Patrol in a processing facility. And that is what they are most concerned about, is how long will that take? Because if you have migrants surging over, thousands of them at one time, where are they going to go? The shelters are already filled up. They do have a few soft-sided facilities, they call them tent facilities, that have been constructed in preparation for Title 42 going away. But those will start to fill up as well. And so some of the policies they've put in place will allow these migrants to be in these facilities, to speak with lawyers within the facilities and to maybe even speak with judges about their asylum requests. And, you know, and in the same time frame, they may be sent back across the border into Mexico or back to their home countries, or they may be allowed to stay into the U.S. and continue on with their asylum request. And so the biggest concern right now from Border Patrol, from agents, and really from the administration, our sources within the administration is, you know, what will it look like? How long will that process take? And you know, are we equipped really to house migrants and their families, you know, for 2, 3, 4 days at a time? You know, if you look back several years ago, this happened during the Trump administration as well, and we saw some people waiting in these facilities, processing facilities. Again, these are not meant to shelter people or families, you know, for long periods of time. They were in these facilities for sometimes weeks. That is the biggest concern we're going to be looking out for in the next week or so when Title 42 goes away.
Yeah, in the meantime, people amassing sort of along the southern border with that date very definitely circled in their minds of May 11th. All right, Maria Villarreal, thank you so much.
Thanks again, Brad.
One of the amazing things about the American form of government is no group is completely in charge of the whole system. Like, a president can sign an order, but the Supreme Court can also say that order's illegal. You don't like that? That's also not the end of the road. Congress could create a law saying that order is legal. But that's also what's made it so confusing when we learned Justice Clarence Thomas has been getting lavish trips paid for by his billionaire friend, the Republican real estate tycoon Harlan Crow. It's not like you can vote out Supreme Court justices, can you? I guess Congress could impeach someone, but there aren't that many hard and fast rules on what justices can do. Or are there?
Today, the Senate Judiciary Committee considers the issue of Supreme Court ethics reform.
Well, yesterday, the Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing to get everyone on the record. What should justices be allowed to do? And how should these rules even be enforced? ABC senior Washington reporter Devin Dwyer is with us. Devin, this sounded like it was all about the Supreme Court, but the justices weren't even there.
A lot of empty seats, Brad. None of the nine took up the invitation from the Senate Democrats to show up. And the Chief Justice, who was himself invited to come and testify about how the Supreme Court governs itself when it comes to ethics, declined to appear.
The reality is that sitting justices have testified at 92 congressional hearings since 1960.
He wrote back, Senate Judiciary Chairman Dick Durbin, a Democrat, that it would be a violation of separation of powers and potentially, in the Chief Justice's view, politicize the court by making him a punching bag over this issue. And make no mistake, it has been a partisan issue. But this was a hearing where, Brad, there was some bipartisan agreement that there needs to be more transparency on the Supreme Court, at the very least, more clarity to the public about what the rules are, what the justices are doing, and how they are or are not complying with those rules.
There are four basic ethics provisions that exist in the executive and legislative branches that do not exist in the Supreme Court.
There were distinguished legal scholars from across the spectrum who are steeped in these issues. Former Attorney General Michael Mukasey from the Bush administration was there. A retired federal judge from California, Jeremy Fogel, was there. He's someone who has some experience sitting on a judicial committee that helps other federal judges comply with disclosure requirements.
Too many Americans already think that the justices decide cases based on their political preferences and alliances rather than the law. Lack of clarity about the justices' ethical obligations only feeds that perception.
The consensus from those ethics experts are that the Supreme Court should be held to some standards, that those standards should be laid out, but there was broad disagreement both among those experts and the lawmakers about how you get there. And can Congress enforce, impose upon the justices some sort of an outside enforcement mechanism to put these rules in place? Discipline justices if necessary, and Republicans were vehemently against that one.
Yeah, wait, how does that work, Devin? Are you like, I know they all sort of oversee each other, but I don't know if I've ever heard of Congress being like, nope, you can't be a justice anymore for doing that thing.
Well, you said it at the outset that the Constitution really only lays out one mechanism for removing a Supreme Court justice once they've been appointed. That's impeachment. Only happened once before in history, and the justice wasn't removed, Samuel Chase back in the 1800s. But that mechanism is there, and that's sort of the counterargument in why we saw last week, Brad, that all nine Supreme Court justices right now, including the three liberals, are pushing back on this effort to regulate the Supreme Court. perhaps out of politics, seeing that this is Democrats sort of seizing on the moment, unhappy with a number of decisions from this conservative majority, trying to, you know, wrangle this court, if you will. But on the other hand, you have Democrats saying this is the only branch of government that doesn't have any, you know, enforceable ethics rules, and that should change.
Ethics cannot simply be left to the discretion of the nation's highest court. The court should have a code of conduct with clear and enforceable rules, so both justices and the American people know when conduct crosses the line.
Senate Judiciary Chairman Dick Durbin of Illinois, who's been on the Judiciary Committee for many years, insisted this hearing is not political. This has been an issue that's been important to him for decades, even when there's been a liberal majority on the Supreme Court. And he says it's simply unfathomable that the
highest court in the land should not have the lowest ethical standards.
So I get why the Supreme Court justices would say, we don't want to have rules from you, Congress. Like, I can understand that. They're not used to being, like, dictated to by Congress. They don't want to be dictated to by Congress. But you said Republicans are really vehemently opposed to any sort of extra rules. What is the rationale? Like, what are there risks to adding too many rules for justices?
The Republican bottom line is that these outside rules are unnecessary and unconstitutional, that the justices, just because they don't have an enforceable code doesn't mean that it's the Wild West on the Supreme Court.
They've targeted specific judges and justices who aren't implementing a liberal agenda that they can't ram through Congress.
One thing we heard yesterday, Brad, was that Republicans see this hearing, the fact that it was even being held as part of a crusade to delegitimize the court, in Republicans' eyes, simply because they're not happy with the decisions that have been coming from this court. We saw in that statement from the nine justices, from the chief justice, there is a broad authorities that they look to when it comes to ethical decision making, both in terms of disclosures, what they're required to tell the public about their financial dealings and their income, but also in terms of conflicts when it comes to cases. How do they recuse from certain cases? What are the guidelines for that? The justices say they do that. They follow voluntarily what other federal judges are obligated to do.
My honor system.
That's right. It's honor system. And we should say, Brad, there are also some very practical concerns about how an outside ethics code would be enforced on the Supreme Court. That's the Chief Justice's biggest objection. How would that actually work if you published rules for when a justice must recuse from a case? He says that could open the door to people gaming the court, trying to bring cases and petitions to get certain justices disqualified in terms of how they're framed, for example.
Judges are expected to comply with high standards of ethics and integrity. And it does appear there needs to be better oversight.
But we even heard from Lindsey Graham, the top Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee, Chuck Grassley, senior Republican from Iowa. Both of those men, while they aren't going so far as to say there needs to be an enforceable code, they did say this court needs to have greater transparency.
And you were telling me, like, let's be clear, there are examples of justices on either side of the spectrum doing favors for, even business with, people who definitely have rooting interests in their decisions. The bizarre thing is still that these rules of what they can and cannot do is still so undefined. Devin Dwyer, thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
All right, one more quick break. When we come back, man, you thought Ding Dong Ditch was fun as a kid? Well, you didn't know where your teachers lived. One last thing is next. One last thing. When I was a kid, it did not occur to me that teachers had a life outside the classroom. Like, one time my parents took me to the horse track, and I saw my teacher, Mrs. DePoe, at a betting window. Like, changes the whole dynamic once you know your teacher missed the exacta. So what would it be like if you knew your elementary school teacher lived out behind the school?
So it's immediately adjacent to one of our playgrounds and play fields. So we are going to be building like a privacy fence.
That's John Scholl, the superintendent for the Chino Valley Unified School District in Arizona, a little north of Phoenix.
We are not the desert. We're high country, up about 4,500 feet. Our school district is 400 square miles.
And Chino Valley has a problem. Teachers are quitting, and new ones feel like they're priced out of the housing market before they even arrive. It's now one of eight different Arizona school districts to get government grants to start building housing on school property for teachers.
But it's just a little piece was to offer affordable housing that could bring in staff, give them an opportunity to get on their feet.
Scholl is the first to admit these houses will be nothing fancy. They're being called studio homes, which you might look at and call tiny houses. 20 by 20 feet, a little wall between the kitchenette and the bed. And while it might sound cramped, this is becoming a much more common perk to offer during the teacher recruiting process.
When I saw it, I was like, oh, great. And I was like, what? I'm a year late. What the heck? So, yes, I think this is such a wonderful opportunity, especially for new teachers.
Other Arizona schools are renovating old hotels. California Governor Gavin Newsom signed a bill last year to make it easier to build faculty housing on school property. But that raises questions of its own. Unions ask what's going to happen when a school is not only your new boss, but your landlord.
I'm going to propose to our board that we allow alcohol on site, but they have to drink inside. They're not going to be outside porch pounding so that people can see what they're doing, right?
No keggers. No teacher keggers. Scholl wants to make the properties non-smoking zones. Marijuana is legal in Arizona, but not on school grounds. And even if teachers are being courted more and more, by the way, Chino Valley already has a 4-day work week to entice them. Is this really a win for anyone? The other way to think of this couldn't be like, this is depressing, right? That we basically have to build temporary low-income housing for teachers because they're so badly paid that this is considered a perk. Like, why? I got to imagine there's a listener being like, why not just pay teachers a wage where they could, like, afford a regular-sized house?
And we would love to. And that would be our first solution.
The superintendent says he's frustrated by how low the pay is, but that falls to the state, he says, not to him.
When you look at where Arizona sits on the amount of money spent per student, we're typically in the bottom five. And so that's more of a political question.
In the meantime, he's going to take what grant money he can to sweeten the deal. And hey, maybe the teachers can come over to his front yard to have a beer, far away from the fifth graders. Also imagine the social scene. Like, would you just want to walk across the playground to your house? Then you're living next to the same people you just saw in the faculty lounge. Like, those are your neighbors now. I don't know. Teachers, would you please weigh in on this? Hit us up on Twitter at StartHereABC. I'm very curious to hear your reaction to this. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia, Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.